Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Ms. Tara Haley. Ms. Haley is a science and multimedia journalist who specializes in reporting on vaccines and other matters of public health, pediatric and maternal health, and mental health, among other topics. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, NPR, Scientific American, Medscape, and the Washington Post. If you want to learn more about her writings and her journey as a writer, please visit her personal website, tarahaley.net. And with that, I'd like to welcome Ms. Haley. How are you doing?
I'm well. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, before we get into the topic, I just want to ask how you're doing, because I understand that over the past few days, it's been a little bit chaotic in your area, and just wanted to touch base and make sure everything was going well.
Yeah, it's basically a spring in Texas. I mean, spring is our tornado season. So, you know, we learn how to duck and cover and find the safest indoor place starting when we're little kids. I haven't lived in Texas all my life, but I've definitely lived here enough years that it's just kind of you just get used to it, I guess.
Well, I appreciate you accommodating this with all the hectic chaos, if you will, going on with the tornado and just the world that is COVID 2022.
I'll say, honestly, of all the things that are chaotic in Texas right now, the tornado is pretty low on that list.
That's saying a lot. So let's get right into your writing, because I think that that is extremely important, particularly as we are going into year two of the pandemic. You have written for some of the most prominent media outlets and also for some niche blog sites as well. You have a very wide range in which you write and your writing can be found. Do you sense a difference in the writing process based on the medium? Meaning, what's similar and what's different than if you're writing for a blog versus writing for the Washington Post?
There's definitely a difference. It is all about audience. I mean, it's, you know, when you teach public speaking, you know, the number one thing is know your audience, right? Same exact thing in journalism. You've got to know your audience. I write for a lot of trade publications, for example, which means that I write for other physicians and researchers. I'm going to use very different language talking to a doctor about, you know, lung cancer than I would talking to a man on the street. So the difference between, like, I just wrapped up a story for Cure magazine about lung cancer immunotherapy, and it's kind of in between the two. It's written for lung cancer patients and their families. So they're going to have a better base level knowledge about lung cancer than kind of just any old random person. But they're certainly not going to have the level that, you know, pulmonologists and oncologists would have. So you have to strike that balance in the middle. So I am constantly thinking about my audience. Same thing with blogs. I just wrote I do a newsletter for Florence Health. And my audience there is nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and RNs. And when I write there, I have a little bit of a playful but still serious tone, if that makes sense. Like, I can crack some jokes. I actually wrote about, you know, six ways to get blood out of your scrubs, which is not the kind of thing that you write for, you know, other places. And I had a little bit of fun with it, right? You know, yeah. Because that's the kind of humor that nurses would have. I that's not necessarily the kind of thing I would publish on, you know, the Washington Post, for example. And, you know, I also pay attention to the style of the actual outlet I'm writing for. Every time I get an assignment from a new publication that I've never written for before, the first thing I do is pull up about six or seven of their articles, and I read those articles, and then I copy and paste the first two graphs, the lead and the nut graph, usually. I copy and paste each of them into a document and look at them all together so that I know, how does this particular publication start off all of its stories? Okay. And then I try and adapt to that. So you have to be, if you're a writer that writes for a wide range of places and sources and topics, you have to be a bit of a chameleon. You know, you have to adapt to the style of the people you're writing for and the people who are reading it. And so that's it. Yeah. Audience is a huge part of it. And it definitely varies. My diction varies. I write sometimes for local, there's a hospital site that I write a lot of times for, where I just explain basic health information. And they have really strict rules where I have to write an eighth grade level, no more than 22 words per sentence, no more than three sentences per paragraph. Wow. And I actually have to check it against a grade checker. Obviously, that's a really different audience than when I'm writing about the exact same topic for like, say, Texas Monthly. You know, it's a, and then there's, you know, in, you know, in tech, if I'm writing for Texas Monthly, I don't have to explain things that Texans already know. But if I write a similar story for New York Times, I'm going to have to give a little bit more context for what, you know, New Yorkers and people across the country reading it who aren't in Texas wouldn't know.
That's interesting. One, it's a testament to your skill as a writer, but two, it also indicates that what you're trying to say is as much influenced by who is reading as much by what you're trying to write. Do you find,
yes,
do you find different thought patterns or different ways of thinking affect the end product? For example, if you were writing about, let's say, COVID masked children, and you were writing for a blog versus a mainstream news outlet, would the constraints of each of the mediums affect the end product?
I think I'm missing part of what you're saying there. So you're saying, do the process of writing have, yeah, go ahead.
The process of writing and conforming to whatever rules each medium may have, do you notice that the end product is materially different or different enough where you feel like, you know, I don't know if I'd actually say this in different ways?
No, I don't. I mean, my goal as a journalist is usually pretty much the same. It's to inform, it's to tell stories. Sometimes it's to entertain. And it's also to educate. And I do distinguish between informing and educating. A lot of journalists don't believe that educating is an important role of journalists. They think informing is, but not educating. And I have a different philosophy on that. I actually used to be a teacher. I still teach periodically, but not full-time. And to me, journalism and my teaching are two sides of the same coin. You know, they both involve, yeah, knowing your audience, but they both involve, there's a difference between, for example, whenever I write about clinical research, which I write a lot about, when I'm writing for AHCJ, the Association of Healthcare Journalists, my actual job is to give tips on how to cover things. So my whole job is actually to educate, right? To educate and, mm-hmm, inform. But I carry over some of those things into my writing for, say, you know, the New York Times or Washington Post or National Geographic, where if I mention something about a clinical trial, or especially Medium, actually, where I have a lot more freedom, if I mention something about a clinical trial, like if I'm talking about an observational trial, for example, I'll purposely use the term epidemiological and observational so that I'm driving home the point that these are similar types of trials, you know, observational trials and epidemiological trial. I will also say something like, you know, because it's an observational trial, you cannot draw cause and effect conclusions, right? I don't need to say that if I'm writing for Medscape, because people at Medscape, I mean, I might mention, I'll say something more like, as an observational trial, you know, it's impossible to know the directionality of the association, right?
Which indirectly is a very different.
Yeah, I mean, that's that, and the doctors reading that know exactly what that means. I wouldn't say that if I was writing at Medium. I would say, you know, observational studies aren't, you know, it's not possible for observational studies to show cause and effect definitively. So I use the writing about the study as an opportunity to educate them on what the scientific process is.
That's interesting. No, it makes perfect sense. And I love the way you phrased that, because it's essentially going into what you emphasize and what you don't emphasize, meaning going to the diction of it, where you're creating certain sentence structuring, where you more emphatically make a point to an audience that may not understand it, but make it almost in passing to an audience that would understand it. So the emphasis, exactly, of the sentencing.
Yeah, and I give a lot of thought to my actual sentence structure, and I'll give you a really specific example of that. One of the challenges when you write a lot about vaccines, which is one of my specialties, is that you can't write about vaccines and not write about autism, because of the long time conflation of vaccine adverse effects and autism, which there isn't a link there, but it's been so inextricably linked because of the damage from the anti-vaccine movement and from Andrew Wakefield's retracted study, that it just, you can't really not, you know, you can't separate them. So what I do is I try to separate them psychologically in my writing. That is, if I say, don't think of an apple, can you not think of an apple? It's not possible. You just thought of an apple the moment I said that. If I say vaccines don't cause autism, I just told you vaccines cause autism in a way, you know, it's like, I have just reinforced the association between vaccines and autism in your brain. And if I need to report on something that someone says that's, you know, prominent, and they're saying things that are inaccurate, what do I do with that? Do I quote them and reinforce that even though I'm about to debunk it? And an example of how I handled this a couple of years ago, there was a district attorney in Bexar County, which is a San Antonio County, who believed that vaccines caused autism and was made a video message saying it. And initially I didn't cover it because I believe in the Barbara Streisand effect. Don't draw attention to something that you don't need to draw attention to until it's brought to, you know, and it caught the national news. Then I had to write about it. And when I wrote about it, I made the headline intentionally convoluted, meaning the headline didn't just roll off the tongue. I didn't say something like Texas DA gives inaccurate information claiming autism's cause, vaccines cause autism, because then I was going to reinforce that very idea with the headline itself. So I don't remember now the exact headline. You could go look it up. It's on Forbes somewhere. But I made it a really convoluted headline that was not smooth to read so that the brain tripped over it on purpose. Oh. I wanted the brain to trip over the idea that vaccines and autism were linked. And then in the lead, I took his quote from the video and I changed the words do to do not, but I put them in bold and I put them in italics, so that his quotes said the opposite of what he said. And then I started the story by saying, those are not the words of District Attorney so-and-so and so-and-so. He said the opposite. That's what he would have said if he was following the correct information of the American Academy of Pediatrics. So, and I, you know, that's, it's kind of walking an ethical line there, but I was very transparent about it. You know, I made it very clear. I drew attention to it, and it's, you know, so that's the kind of thing that I'm thinking all the time. I do a lot of talks about why people fear vaccines and about vaccine hesitancy. And a lot of it goes back to our cognitive biases. Mm. And this has become even more important today. I think, you know, I don't think epistemology is something that needed to be taught, you know, 50 years ago. But today, epistemology, like the science of knowing what you know and how you know and why you know it and why you believe it, to me, that is one of the most important things we can talk about now, because social media manipulates that so much, not intentionally so, but just, well, some people do intentionally, but, you know, with algorithms and whatnot, I think we need to be giving more thought to why do we know what we know, and how is our, you know, how are our own experiences and history and cognitive biases interfering with that. And I am hyper conscious of those biases when I am writing. I write with them in mind. You know, what am I tapping into when I write this? What should I avoid? You know, what kinds of associations might I inadvertently make? And I try to be conscious myself. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go back and read my Twitter feed and just search for the word bias, I'll sometimes say, like, you know, I think I believe this, but I'm trying to check my biases here. So what am I missing? You know, I literally did that 2 days ago. And so, and that aspect, it infiltrates all of my writing across the board. I mean, when I write for Science in the Sea, which is once a month, under 300 words, super short, you know, things about ocean creatures that are cool, that goes to the UT Marine Science Center, right? Really, really simple. But that same column runs in Saltwater Fishing Magazine in Southern Texas. What I might say to the UT Marine Science Center and what I might say to saltwater fishermen in Southern Texas about ocean creatures, you can imagine how there's a difference there. And so I'm conscious of that when I'm writing it, especially if I'm writing about climate change. You know, I don't shy away from anything. I don't give, you know, I don't twist anything or give any inaccurate info, but I am conscious of the kind of biases that both of my different audiences are coming to with those stories.
Wow. First off, kudos on the Forbes article and using, in many ways, reverse heuristics to I admire and am taken aback at how skillfully you've been able to put cognitive biases in the forefront of scientific topics. And I think it has a lot to do with your traditional education, if I may be so bold to say, your ability to think non-technically about otherwise technical topics lends a certain unique angle. And
I do think that. I think the fact that, you know, a lot of science journalists come into the field from different angles. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are former scientists and then they go into science journalism. Other people are journalists and then they go to a science journalism program. The last science class that I took as an actual course, I audited an epidemiology course and I audited a course on medical ethics when I was in grad school back in 2011. But before that, the last class I actually took as a science class, I was 19 years old. I'm in my 40s now. So I don't have, you know, I don't have a master's in science. I don't have like a formal scientific background. And I'm not saying that I shouldn't have one. I'm not saying that people who have that are hampered by it at all. I think, you know, obviously learning the scientific method and how to think scientifically and critically are important. But I also think that my strong liberal arts background, which is where most of it comes from, is where a lot of, you know, I have a deep appreciation, not only for science, but for the liberal arts and for philosophy and for, you know, sociology and literature and history and how all those things interconnect.
Yeah, I think that shows in your writings on vaccines, particularly.
Thank you.
During the pandemic. I think that you brought a very unique angle to a very important subject. And I want to touch on that because I think it's important for people to know. During the pandemic, you were a very prominent voice advocating for vaccines. And sometimes you spoke for people who were struggling to find their own voice. I would imagine that was, in many ways, reliving what you wrote in your book, Vaccine Investigation, The History and Science of Vaccines. You wrote many articles in Scientific American, but you still faced backlash. And you were not, and again, I want to be careful here, you were not perceived as a subject matter expert compared to somebody who was in the medical field, a physician, a pediatrician. And in many ways, you had to combat vaccine misinformation coming from those who otherwise would be considered in a more traditional sense as subject matter experts. So I'm
done
curious.
Your homework, sir.
I did my homework because it was worth the time. It was worth the time to look into this because
this is the first interview I've ever had where someone knew that much about my Twitter account. You're absolutely correct.
well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I think the point I'm trying to drive home is that you were advocating for vaccines, yet you are not a physician. But you are a subject matter expert on vaccines. You wrote a book. You're essentially debating, in sometimes more emotional ways than not, physicians, pediatricians who are advocating against vaccines that are going against traditional medical thought, who people think are subject matter expertise. So it's almost like, what is a subject matter expert and what is right or wrong?
Good questions, not good answers. Like there aren't good answers to that. And we're in a really critical moment right now. We have a small but influential and loud group of what I call COVID minimizers. Mm-hmm. We're minimizing the impact of COVID on children and the value of vaccines for children. And they come from, you know, they come from medical backgrounds and from institutions that are well recognized and respected. And it's hugely problematic. And what I try and do is I distinguish between being a subject matter expert and being an expert, which is to say, I'm always upfront about what I do and don't know. You know, I am not going to tell you that I have a degree in immunology because I don't have anything close to a degree in immunology. I know a lot more immunology than the man on the street, but I don't know even a third or, you know, a tenth of what an actual immunologist knows, right? Mm-hmm. But I can spot when an immunologist is using arguments that are not good arguments because I am very good at logic and my degree is in English. And guess what a big part of English is? Rhetoric.
Yeah.
So while I may not be a subject matter expert in immunology, I am an expert in identifying bad arguments and bad use of evidence and cherry picking.
Right.
So I look at the data. I also tell people that I am an expert on experts, which is to say, no, I can't possibly be an expert on pediatric cardiology and myocarditis and immunology and vaccine development. But what I can be is an expert on finding the people who are the experts in those fields and finding a wide range of them. I know how to go to PubMed and find researchers with diverse viewpoints within those fields, but which still stick to the data. So that I know I'm not pigeonholing myself in a place where I'm only getting one sort of party line, if you will. I'm getting a diversity of input from different practitioners in the field who are experienced, but I'm not getting non-evidence-based cranks, basically. You know, now that's not to say that the people who are all promoting that information are cranks. It's just that they're out of their lane, to be frank. I mean, one of the most vocal people who is misframing the benefits of vaccines for kids, he's an adult oncologist. He's never, he's a hematologist. he's not, he doesn't treat kids, and he sure as heck doesn't treat infectious disease.
Right.
You know, some of the other ones that are out there, one's an adult cardiologist, one's a physical therapist. One is an epidemiologist that doesn't even treat patients. Another is an adult internist. I mean, I'm not giving names here, but your people listening will recognize those. There's also a certain brown economist out there who Brown is in Brown University, not the color of their skin, who passes themselves off as an expert in health economics that they are not an expert in, because it's clear that their data is poorly presented. There's lots of holes in the data. So to me, it goes back to, what is the data, and are you being intellectually honest and thorough in the data that you're looking at, or are you cherry picking it? You know, and that's what I focus on. And I also point out, you know, clearly if I was doing things that were, if I was missing the mark in some way, then the people who are calling on me to talk to them, you know, I've given talks to the AAP, the National Institutes of Health brought me on as one of their experts for a panel on vaccine hesitancy when they put together their booklet. I was the only person out of about, I don't know, 15 panel members who didn't have an MD or a PhD.
Wow.
Clearly they wouldn't have invited me if I wasn't, you know, if they didn't think I had the chops. And that's not to brag, it's to say that I've put in the effort. And I also try to remain modest about what I don't know. I'm, you know, the one thing that I think is perhaps the most important thing for journalists to always be aware of is there's always so much you don't know. And the more you realize what you don't know, the better journalist you're going to be. You know, even when I think I know something, I'll ask I'll ask questions where I think I know the answers, because sometimes I get an answer and it's not what I was expecting. Yeah. And if I just assumed that I knew what the answer was, I wouldn't be a very good journalist. So, you know, all of that kind of goes into that. And it's a part of my public speaking. It's a part of the books I write. It's a part of my journalism. It's a part of who I am as a person. It's a part of how I parent. You know, my kids ask me questions about things. You know, what's this, mommy? What does that mean? And it even, you know, it's more about how I live my life. It's interesting because I hear people say things like, you know, journalism is my job, not my life. And I understand what they're saying. And we do need boundaries, you know, work-life boundaries, which I try to maintain. And I think I do a decent job at it. But journalism is my identity as much as mom is my identity, you know? And so I'm a naturally curious person who wants to understand knowledge. And if I'm not willing to understand when I could be wrong and you know, learn more when I'm wrong, then I'd be a pretty crappy journalist.
I find what you're saying to be incredibly fascinating, because science is in many ways the art of negation. Meaning, as you try to prove, you essentially identify what is disproven, and then you come to certain fundamental understandings. In many ways, you incorporate that ethos into your writing when you talk about rhetoric.
Yes, I feel like actually the journalism process to me mirrors the scientific process a lot.
Yeah,
which is to say, you send a pitch to your editor. And that pitch is kind of your hypothesis, right? Mm-hmm. I have an idea that this is what the story is. Once you start collecting data, right? Instead of experiment, you call people, right? You interview them, you do reporting, and you're collecting data, okay? Your hypothesis, if you're doing a scientific experiment, you don't change your hypothesis. You try and prove it or disprove it. But as a journalist, you're sort of you're shifting. You're like, it's almost like you're doing multiple studies in time. Like instead of doing hypothesis, data, analysis, conclusion, new hypothesis based on that conclusion, you're kind of doing that process over and over again.
It's iterative, per sentence, per paragraph.
You're revising your hypothesis as you go based on the data coming in.
That's brilliant.
And, you know, you may or may not come to a conclusion, right? Yeah. I mean, sometimes I write a story and there's not a conclusion. I wrote a story for an NPR a number of years ago about birth control, hormonal birth control, oral contraceptives, and mental health, depression. And the bottom line is, we don't know. Like we don't have enough. There's good reasons to think that there could be a link there. There's good reasons to think there's not a link there. There's a lot of confounding in the data. And so, you know, I don't remember now if I went into that. In that case, I don't think I had a hypothesis other than, is there a connection, right? It was more like a question. But it's that same process of propose a hypothesis, gather data, do your reporting, look at the data, analyze it, move it around. What are the holes? What are you still missing? What more data do you need? And what can we analyze and draw out of this based on that? And then synthesize it. Well, which also, by the way, is the Bloom's taxonomy ladder of learning.
I'm glad you phrased that, because that's essentially how writing works, right? You focus on the subject predicate, the verb empowers the sentence because it creates the logic coherence in the sentence. Mm-hmm. So by writing, you essentially are creating a pattern of learning that is not, as you mentioned, leading towards a conclusion, but instead exercising certain patterns of thinking, which I think goes back to what you had mentioned, where you say, writing is a form of teaching.
Yeah.
And more broadly speaking, it's a dissemination of information, both good and bad. And in many ways, when you are a journalist, when you're a writer, you're influencing the story as much as you are by writing the story.
Oh,
as
yeah,
you
sure.
alluded
to. What is that? What's that scientific principle where you
observational
can't,
effect.
Yeah, the one where just the observation alone can have an yeah, exactly. Yeah. In fact, that's something I think a lot about when it comes to journalistic ethics. Mm-hmm. My master's is not actually in writing journalism, it's in photojournalism.
Yeah.
And, you know, photojournalists like to think of themselves as recording what's happening and being, you know, bearing witness to what's in front of them. But you can't be a photojournalist in the middle of whatever's happening and not influence what's happening, right? People see the camera. They may act differently because they see the camera. Other people might move away from you. You know, you might be a repel to, you know, you might repel people. The other people might draw towards you. Like you can't operate in a vacuum. You're not invisible. Mm-mm. And I think photojournalists have a better sensibility about that than I think writing journalists do. And that's a loose distinction, since a lot of people do all, you know, multimedia and all forms of journalism. But I think journalists do need to be aware of the fact that, this kind of goes to the heart of a whole other philosophical discussion in journalism about objectivity and whether objectivity is ever really possible. I don't think it is. I think the idea of objectivity is a red herring of sorts, right? We all have perspectives. We all have biases. What's better is to be transparent. And I think, you know, if you're expecting a journalist to become an expert in writing in an area, let's say a journalist covers a city council every single day for 3 years, are you going to expect that journalist to not have any opinions at all about the city? I mean, they can't, you know, it's like, that's against human nature. But are you going to tell me that that journalist's opinions shouldn't be listened to because they're a journalist? Well, they know more about that city council than anybody else there is, you know. So it doesn't mean you have to agree with their opinion, but you can't say it's not an informed opinion.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, going to that, you know, journalists have to realize that we are of the world, not outside the world. You know, we can't hover above it. We can't be invisible. We are a part of it. We live in it. And honestly, I think that's something I've always kind of believed, but I there was a big sort of watershed moment for me when that really, when I crossed the Rubicon, if you will.
Yeah.
Was the 2016 election. Because then I had all these different values that were conflicting. Like, how do I be a quote unquote objective, you know, how do I try to remain fair, balanced, unbiased, when quite frankly, somebody who resembled a lot of what early Hitler did was coming to power and was, you know, promoting ideas that were very similar to other authoritarian governments. I can't pretend like I don't know history, because I know my history.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean I'm not fair. It doesn't mean I don't reach out and make sure I'm not misrepresenting someone or you know, making assumptions. But I was in a situation where, you know, I used to teach high school, right? I have people I love who are gay, lesbian, Black, Latino, undocumented, you know, Jewish, you know. I'm not going to pretend like those people aren't my friends when I'm a journalist. I don't stop being friends with them because I'm a journalist.
Right.
And I don't stop caring about their lives as human rights, you know, because I'm a journalist. And I think that's a really dicey, that tension is something I think every journalist kind of has to confront on their own and deal with. And there's not, I don't think there's like super simple answers to it. I think there are some right answers and there are some wrong answers, but there's probably a lot more gray answers than there are right or wrong answers.
Isn't that the point, you think, where it has to be subjective? Because then as a writer, you're able to input that form of thinking that drives the point you're trying to make.
Yeah. I mean, we can't operate as non-subjective animals. We right. are subjective animals, you yeah. know? I mean, is it called the Heisenberg principle? Is that where the observational
uncertainty? The uncertainty principle?
Yes. I mean, that how much more objective can you get and it yeah. not work? Right? Yeah. I mean, if the purest form of science, which, well, mathematicians will say it's math, but then after that, it's probably physics.
Yeah.
If one of the purest forms of science can't be objective, why the heck do we think we as biological animals can be?
Yeah, exactly. And what I think that played out most apparent in the pandemic, when there was a certain level of uncertainty that overwhelmed the science. And I don't think for many, they were comfortable with so much objective facts, so much empirical data being overwhelmed with uncertainty, where in many ways, the uncertainty were n degrees or n orders greater than actual certainty or empirical facts. Yeah. In that light, how would you look at some of the efforts of journalists to try to make sense of what was going on? Do you feel that they were valiant efforts, or you felt a lot of them just kind of got overwhelmed in the moment?
I think there's a couple things going on there. First of all, I think one of the things that's fundamentally unusual about covering science relative to covering any other type of topic area is that the fundamental heart of science is uncertainty, right? Uncertainty is literally the foundation on which science sits. The it's a system of saying, I don't know, or as people like, can we curse on this?
Sure.
Fuck around and find out, right? I mean, the whole heart of science, its entire roots, everything about it is on this foundation of, I don't know jack. Let me try and find out. And the more you find out, the more questions you have, right? And the more you find out, the more questions you have. I mean, it's everything in science revolves around uncertainty, right? Yeah. But in our everyday lives, uncertainty is uncomfortable, unfamiliar, anxiety inducing, right? It's not how we like to live our lives. We want to live our lives with certainty. And, you know, sports, who won, who didn't win, it's, you know, or who tied, like there's no uncertainty there. I mean, you can argue over a couple of calls, but, you know, business and politics, I mean, there's fuzzy areas in all of those, but uncertainty is not kind of the core of what it is, right? It's more an incidental aspect of it. When we were seeing the way that I describe what happened during the pandemic is that it's the famous sausage factory analogy, right? You don't want to see how the sausage is made when it comes to politics. Well, most people, they know that politics is a sausage factory and they know they don't want to look at that sausage factory. They're quite well aware of that. They don't realize that science is a sausage factory. They think science is fact. They think science is right or wrong. They don't think of science as a process for gaining knowledge. They think of science as a body of knowledge, which is the exact opposite of what science is. And so what happened during the pandemic is all these people who thought science was like a collection of facts, suddenly they've got their noses pressed up against the glass of the sausage factory, and they're seeing all the crap that's in there. You know, they're seeing the bad hot dogs, and they're seeing the sausages that have gone rotten, and they're seeing, you know, the good bits, and, you know, and they're seeing them put all you know, you can have as much fun with this analogy as you want. But the bottom line is, I think that made a lot of people really uneasy. It was like they used to think that their sausages were made from this perfect machine that cranked out like an identical sausage every single time, like clockwork. And all of a sudden they find out how messy it all is. That's what they've been swallowing all these years. Are you kidding me? And now you want me to change my life based on that? You want to use that to tell me what my new diet should be? You know? And I think that's the sort of crisis a lot of people were going through. They had no choice but to pay attention to science, whether they wanted to or not. And they had no choice but to acknowledge the uncertainty. And some people couldn't do that. So they sought out certainty. And where did they seek out certainty? In people that gave them certainty. And if you were finding certainty in the pandemic, you were getting misinformation. I'm not saying there's nothing you can say. I mean, obviously there are things we now have enough information to conclude, but you know, every time you felt lost and uncertain and you got an answer that you felt definitively answered the question that you had, you probably didn't get the right answer.
That's interesting. So could you say that science and conspiracy go hand in hand?
Ooh, that's a good question. I've never been asked before. I think probably it's, I would say human nature and conspiracy go hand in hand, honestly. I mean, I would say human nature, it's human nature to have inquiry and have questions. I mean, you know, to experiment. I mean, you see, there are elephants who experiment. There are chimpanzees that experiment. So maybe it's, you know, I think it's natural for us to have questions and to seek and to be curious and to question. And it's also, you know, and to seek answers. And I think if you're seeking answers, sometimes you're going to go down a wrong path and right. look for connections. You know, our brains are designed to look for patterns, right? That's how our brains operate. That's what heuristics is, right? Looking for patterns. We can't function if we can't make sense of the world in front of us. So we need patterns to understand our world. And if we start to see a couple facts and we see them selectively, we're going to draw conclusions from those patterns, right? That may not be accurate. Going back to journalists covering the actual pandemic, I think it really depends on who you're talking about. Health and science journalists made a valiant effort. And I think there was a lot of great journalism that came out as a result. The problem is that health and science journalists were not in the White House press corps. And the bulk of the news that we were getting in our headlines in the, you know, for the first year of the pandemic, it was coming from the White House press room and or from national figures like Fauci or, you know, whomever. It was, but that was being reported on by political journalists. And political journalists have a completely different approach and sensibility to reporting on something than health and science journalists do. And so I think the biggest mistake that was made in terms of coverage of the pandemic from the sort of big picture institution of journalism was, you know, in the media, was not taking all those political journalists out of that room or, you know, and putting a science journalist in their place. Right. Or at least partnering them up. Now, I know it's easier said than done because it's an involved process to get the right help, you know, to get clearance for the White House press. I mean, it's not like they just hand out cards, right? There's an application process, but there needed to. Now, of course, I say that and the Trump administration never would have allowed that. Right. I mean, we know that that's wishful thinking on several levels. But I think the biggest mistake was not at least pairing up every person in that White House press corps room, every person talking to these, you know, every political reporter that was talking to these people about the pandemic, every single one of them should have been working with a health and science journalist who understood how to report on this. And I think that was because so many things were poorly communicated as a result of that. And I think that was especially, I mean, we could have a whole conversation about false balance, right? Where you're trying to balance one side with the other, but the evidence heavily favors one and not the other, right? You can still report on both of them, but you got to report on them within the context of 90% of the evidence supports X and only 10% of the evidence supports Y. We can still cover X and Y, but 90% of your story better be about X. Or you're not, you know, if you present X and Y as 50-50 when the evidence is 90-10, you're not doing your job. I think, you know, political journalists are trained to think of everything as 50-50 because they're trying to report objectively about two major political parties.
I think health journalists better understand the inherent irrationality in certain topics, particularly healthcare topics. And I think that they're better at avoiding the bias to be more fearful of smaller events and to or underwhelm more common events, meaning they don't see that false equivalency of a 50-50 that you would see in other situations.
Have a huge case study in health journalism where we all learned our lesson. I mean, vaccines are the classic example.
Yeah.
If you want the best case study there is on how health journalists screwed up reporting, look at the history of our reporting of vaccines. Curtis Brannard has a fantastic article called Sticking with the Truth. It's Columbia Journalism Review. It came out maybe, 7 or 8 years ago. And he kind of outlines basically how we all screwed the pooch on that one.
Well, for those who may not be familiar with that, can you just give a very brief background on that?
Sure. Pardon me. The bottom line is that when Andrew Wakefield published his article, his Lancet case series, which is, you know, I think it was 12 kids in 1998, that news didn't actually make it to the US until 2000. You know, this is the early days of the internet. And as it got reported on over time and as other studies came out, it was presented as, do vaccines cause autism or do vaccines not cause autism? Person A says they cause autism. Person B says they don't. But the problem is that's not what the evidence showed. The evidence showed, even very early on, the evidence showed, first of all, the Lancet study it was 12 kids. It was a case series. Even before we knew about the fraud and, you know, the fact that even though we knew, we found out later that there was fraudulent data and there was problems, but even if you put that aside, even if you pretend like the study was legit aside from that, it was 12 kids in a case series. That's not that's not a study you would cover. And everyone was treating it like that was the study that said vaccines cause autism. And then there's like, you know, 15, you know, observational things over here. And you look at the RCT data from the actual vaccine trials before approval showing no signals, and you're presenting it as a 50-50. And that's what journalists did for a decade. And you can see the fruits of that, the rotten fruits of that, in hesitancy today with the COVID vaccine. I mean, that, you know, the roots of how journalists, had a false equivalency, you know, did not adequately distinguish between the weight of the evidence in the different questions that were out there within the uncertainty within those questions. The long-term legacy of that is what we're seeing play out right now.
Wow. It's amazing how things from the past continue to manifest in the future.
It's almost like history matters.
You would think, right? And, you know, let's maybe transition from history to the future. So let's take where we are now. You know, we've had 2 years of the pandemic under our belt, lessons learned and hopefully not forgotten, although people are people. And so there will be some repetition. Where do you see health journalism going from here? What are the future trends?
I think we've made great strides in it. And I think there's a lot more awareness and motivation to be more thoughtful about how we cover health and science topics, which sounds very optimistic. And I am optimistic about the journalism. What I'm less optimistic about is our leadership. More broadly, our political leadership and our public health leadership. I mean, let's just say that, you know, if I had the rug pulled out from under me when Trump was elected, I lost all my religion when the CDC started behaving the way it did during the pandemic. I could never have anticipated. I had criticized the CDC before. It's not like I held them up on some pedestal, but I mean, they weren't the FDA. Like, you want to give a list of problems. Let's focus on the FDA, right? The CDC was, you know, it seemed like they tried, right? They were the kid that might have screwed up now and then, but they had your best interests at heart and they kept on trying anyway, right? That all went out the window. I mean, I have no faith in the CDC now. I just don't even know what to think. I don't even know how to think of them as an agency. And that's a real shame, because there's a lot of wonderful public servants who work there or who worked there. In fact, most of the people I know who were there that I trusted have left, which is telling in and of itself. And so I don't have a lot of optimism there. I am very concerned about where our country is headed and how the level of polarization we have, the misinformation and the tyranny of the algorithm. And I mean, it does feel a little bit end times-ish, right? I that has challenged my natural disposition toward optimism. In terms of journalists covering it, though, I do have a lot of optimism. And I, you know, we saw a lot of journalists step up. The Washington Post is a great example when Trump was elected. And I think we're seeing sort of a golden age of, you know, investigative journalism. There's more ways to find things out. At the same time, it's harder to, it's all fragmented, right? And it's a lot easier to get into your journalism bubbles. So journalists can do an incredible job. The question is whether it's getting to the right people. And that's a totally different question. So even if I thought that journalists were doing the most amazing job they possibly could, if they're not reaching 40% of the population, you know, what's that doing for us? And we can't control that, right? It's funny. It's one of the reasons I go on Fox News when I'm invited. If I'm invited to Fox News, I go, because I don't get to talk to that audience very often, you know? And I think about who that audience is. Okay, I do little things. Like when I appear on Fox News, I take the little RBG and Hillary dolls on top of my bookcase off of my bookcase. You know? So I am optimistic. I do think that we're going in a good direction and we're learning and we're trying. And I think that is not able to be separated from a broader social movement toward, you know, we're in the middle of this sort of, I mean, not to get all philosophical and political, but we're seeing a huge push-pull tug of war between progressives and conservatives that I think are acting the way an animal acts when it's dying and it's in the corner and it's still trying to hold on to life and attack, right?
Yeah.
And I'm revealing tons of biases of my own when I say that, and I'm doing that freely. You know, you see it in all these anti-transgender bills, you see it in the abortion and women's bills, you know, there's so many ways that you're seeing sort of this massive desire to, you know, yank us back to the 19 whatevers. And then you've also got all these people who now have a voice that didn't have a voice before social media. I mean, social media is like the double-edged sword. You know, we have the wokeness, if you will, which can be itself a double-edged sword in the way that term is used. But we have a recognition that race, you know, look at the racial reckoning that we had in 2020. We can't pretend, you know, nobody can pretend like racism isn't real anymore. So a couple of folks out there are trying to very desperately. But I mean, it's like saying, no, that elephant in front of me is not an elephant, I swear. You know, you can't. So I think there's all of that is, I think, interacting with the journalism as well. I think that's, you know, again, we're all part of our own, you know, society. And I'm kind of rambling and getting all philosophical, so stop there, but you get it.
No, I fully get it. And let's do this then. We covered so many topics, and I really enjoyed gaining your perspective on so many things and just matching the personality in your voice with the personality in your writing. So thank you for that. It's what you see is what
that's
you get.
That's pretty transparent too. My voice is my voice is my voice.
No, it's a compliment and it's a testament to the quality of your writing. You. Let's conclude with one point. And as a photojournalist, let's make that point a picture. So if you had one picture that encapsulates the past 2 years, the pandemic itself, and you had to describe it for the listening audience, what would that picture be?
Like an actual, like an image, like a photojournalism kind of image?
Yeah.
Okay, this is kind of amusing. So because I used to teach photojournalism and journalism in high school, I also sometimes serve as a judge for college and high school photography contests. Mm-hmm. There was recently a college shootout that it's where a bunch of college students go to New York City and they have a 2-day period in which they have to shoot image, they can turn it up to 2 images. And each of those images has to represent whatever the theme is. Mm. And the theme was to create an image of New York postcard worthy that encapsulates where we are right now after the past 2 years of what we've just gone through. The photo that I chose as my number one first choice ended up winning the competition.
Wow.
And that photo, it was taken in Times Square, and it was a picture of one of those, you know how there's always people dressed up in Times Square doing pictures and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. It was a little kid posing with a Spider-Man in Times Square. The woman taking the picture was dressed half like a furry. Like she had this sort of like big thing, you know, bear head on her face. And it was pulled up and she was taking the picture and she was laughing. Like her face was bright and wide. But the picture was framed in a way that also he used beautiful framing and beautiful shutter speed. Spider-Man was crisp and frozen in time. She was crisp and frozen in time. And what looked like his parents looking on were moving a little bit. And then behind them, all of the activity that was going on, it was movement, right? So he probably used a flash to freeze the action right in front of him, but used a slow shutter speed so that the background people were sort of blurred a bit and moving. And some of them were wearing masks and some of them weren't wearing masks. And they were, you know, it was busy, but it was also not the same. And I think it encapsulated all of that so beautifully. It encapsulated our need for fantasy, our need for connection, but also the masks, life is never going to be the same again. It captured that frenetic tension between movement and stillness. I can't tell you what happened in 2020 versus 2022. If I try and think back to a meeting I had with someone, or a phone call I had, the period from 2020 to 2022 feels like one long year. Mm-hmm. I can't, my time is all warped. And that's kind of how it felt. It's like you've got fast and slow in the same image, right? You're frozen in time. You're frozen in this 2-year period, but you've been moving forward all along. And sometimes it's moving too fast. Like, holy cow, Delta's here. Whoa, Omicron. Whoa, it's climbing. Okay, it's down. No, wait, next to you, it's a roller coaster. And that image kind of encapsulated all of that together. It captured the fantasy with the Spider-Man and our need for that entertainment and our need for outlet. It connect, you know, our connections, our joy, our fears, all of that together.
Wow. So,
that I can send you the photo. I'll send you the Flickr link to the photo. If you wanted to put it anywhere, you'd have to get their permission for it. But it's just a brilliant photo.
No, certainly. I think that I will try to get it and post it alongside this podcast. I think it would be very appealing for the audience. And with that, Ms. Haley, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your insights. For anybody who's made it this far into the podcast, please read more about Ms. Haley's work. You could start by going to tarahaley.net. And you can find her readings all over, from Forbes to Medium to New York Times and Washington Post. So please take the time, read her work. You will learn quite a bit. Thank you.